Chapter 1, Our Demand and Need from the Gita, published on the 15th of August in 1916, his birthday. We've noted that and talked how Sri Aurobindo will go to the core of what is the Gita's message, based upon experience, his own and the entire spiritual tradition, virtually, of India. The Gita is precious. It is thousands of years old, and we won't linger often or long on historical data, but I think we should note that the Mahabharata was well into its composition in the centuries prior to the Common Era, and at least the core of the Bhagavad Gita, which is key to the understanding of the whole conflict captured in the Mahabharata, was probably in some form present in the second or third century BCE. We'll come back to points like that later, where it's relevant, and I hope you will be indulgent when we do return. Sri Aurobindo begins with this wonderful chapter and concludes with a peroration which rings throughout the ages. We'll get to it in a couple of pages. We're going to continue here, roughly in the middle of the chapter. He's saying what we will and won't do. Nor shall we deal in any other spirit with the element of philosophical dogma or religious creed, which either enters into the Gita or hangs about it owing to its use of the philosophical terms and religious symbols current at the time. When the Gita speaks of Sankhya and Yoga, we shall not discuss beyond the limits of what is just essential for our statement, the relations of the Sankhya of the Gita with its one Purusha and strong Vedantic coloring to the non-theistic or atheistic Sankhya that has come down to us, bringing with it its scheme of many Purushas and one Prakriti, nor of the Yoga of the Gita, many-sided, subtle, rich, and flexible to the theistic doctrine and the fixed, scientific, rigorously defined and graded system of the Yoga of Patanjali. Now, that's a very rich statement and probably deserves to be unraveled a little bit. Because Sankhya is an old, possibly pre-Aryan insight from ancient India, whose strong position is that if one looks at one's nature, one realizes that there is something essential looking at that nature. Who is that witness that can gaze at all our phenomenal being, at our body and our emotions and our mental activities and recognize that I'm watching this? Who is this watcher, this sakshi, this witness, this person, this purusha? If that's the core element of Sankhya, then its combination with yoga in the six darshanas in subsequent centuries puts into philosophic form one of the earliest traditions in Indian thought. But that's not the Sankhya of the Gita. And the yoga of the Gita is not what we associate with Patanjali. There are references to elements of the practice of a kind of yoga that looks like Patanjali's, but the Yoga Sutras, which we associate with Patanjali, come several hundred years after the Bhagavad Gita is composed. It dates roughly from the 3rd century CE. So we're looking at something in the Gita which is formative, but which has not been formed, which is leaning into experience and has not been caught by formalities, is not a prisoner of the structure of a philosophy. So this leads us again to the point that Sri Aurobindo is making. We want the Gita to lead us, to be our guru, to teach us, to reveal to us the truth of self, of world, of what is beyond both. So he continues in this paragraph, in the Gita, the Sankhya and Yoga are evidently only two convergent parts of the same Vedantic truth, or rather, two concurrent ways of approaching its realization. The one, philosophical, intellectual, analytic, that's Sankhya. The other, intuitional, devotional, practical, ethical, synthetic, reaching knowledge through experience. The Gita recognizes no real difference in their teachings. Still less need we discuss the theories which regard the Gita as the fruit of some particular religious system or tradition. Its teaching is universal, whatever may have been its origins. And of course, it's commonly taken that the Bhagavad Gita is an ode to the wonders of Vaishnavism, centering on Vishnu. And yet, there are scholars who trace similarities in the Gita all the way back to the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, as well as the Katha. And there, of course, it is clearly Maheshwara, Shiva, who is being invoked, who is receiving the attention. It is interesting, in the Gita, there is not much mention, is there, of this particular point. Krishna is central because it is through him that a transcendent supreme person has consciously placed itself upon the earth for a particular mission. But that is not a particular religious system. That is the recognition of a deep need that the soul has to participate in the world, whether it's the Supreme Soul or we ourselves. We come again and again to fight the good fight, to perfect our approach, to enlarge our consciousness, to open our hearts. And who better to lead us than the Supreme itself? Where do we find it best? At the core of our own being. Whether it is a he or a she, certainly it is. Its teaching is universal, whatever may have been its origins. The philosophical system of the Gita, its arrangement of truth, is not that part of its teaching which is most vital, profound, eternally durable, but most of the material of which the system is composed, the principal ideas suggestive and penetrating, which are woven into its complex harmony, are eternally valuable and valid, for they are not merely the luminous ideas or striking speculations of a philosophic intellect, but rather enduring truths of spiritual experience, verifiable facts of our highest psychological possibilities, which no attempt to read deeply the mystery of existence can afford to neglect. This is an important statement. It's true. What has been systematized in the Gita, in its teaching of the three Purushas, and the recognition that both jnana, essential knowledge, and vijnana, the mastering knowledge that moves out and composes and controls the expression and manifestation, are one, are spoken of together. The three persons, the kshara, the akshara, the purushottama, all express ranges of spiritual experience that we don't have a glimpse of even in the Upanishads. The Gita is part of these three volumes which form Vedanta for us, that which comes after the Veda, the books of knowledge, the Upanishads, Brahma Sutras, and then the Gita. And the Gita has the largest synthesis. It doesn't get lost in the details, it states them. And it will be a great delight for you to go through and see how the Gita, beginning slowly, leads the inquirer, the seeker, from point to point, from experience to experience, until one rather arrives at the grandest possible culmination in which all is vibrantly one, full of light, full of love, dynamic in action. Whatever the system may be, it is not, as the commentators strive to make it, framed or intended to support any exclusive school of philosophical thought, or to put forward predominantly the claims of any one form of yoga. The language of the Gita, the structure of thought, the combination and balancing of ideas, belong neither to the temper of a sectarian teacher, nor to the spirit of a rigorous analytical dialectics, cutting off one angle of the truth to exclude all the others. But rather, there is a wide, undulating, encircling movement of ideas, which is the manifestation of a vast synthetic mind and a rich synthetic experience. This is one of those great syntheses in which Indian spirituality has been as rich as in its creation of the more intensive, exclusive movements of knowledge and religious realization that follow out with an absolute concentration, one clue, one path to its extreme issues. It does not cleave asunder, but reconciles and unifies. So he'll get to the differentiations in just a moment. The thought of the Gita is not pure monism, although it sees in one unchanging, pure, eternal self the foundation of all cosmic existence, nor Mayavada, though it speaks of the Maya of the three modes of Prakriti, omnipresent in the created world. Nor is it the qualified monism, although it places in the One his eternal supreme Prakriti manifested in the form of the Jiva, and lays most stress on dwelling in God rather than dissolution as the supreme state of spiritual consciousness. Nor is it Sankhya, although it explains the created world by the double principle of Purusha and Prakriti. Nor is it Vaishnava theism, although it presents to us Krishna, who is the avatara of Vishnu according to the Puranas, as the supreme deity, and allows no essential difference nor any actual superiority of the status of the indefinable relationless Brahman over that of this Lord of beings, who is the master of the universe and the friend of all creatures. So there, he's just raced through the entirety of Indian philosophy, has he not? Monism, of course, we associate with Shankara, Advaita Vedanta. Not two. There are not two realities. Advaita. Not two. But, and yes, there is a self. There is an Atman. There is an Akshara Purusha. But this is not Mayavada. Let's note that the Gita is, perhaps a millennium earlier than Shankara. 800-900 years at least. Qualified monism, of course, Vishishta Dvaita, we know from Ramanuja. And there are great studies. You'll find even some deep parallels between Sri Aurobindo's interpretation of the manifold teaching of the Gita with Ramanuja's. But that is not what the Gita is teaching solely. And it is certainly not Sankhya. You can't say that it's a captive of Vaishnavism, which, by the way, only begins to make a historical appearance hundreds of years later. This Ishvara, who is identical with the oneness of Brahman, who is non-manifest and manifest and above both poises, containing within its infinity all possibilities, is the Lord of the Gita. Like the earlier spiritual synthesis of the Upanishads, he writes, this later synthesis, at once spiritual and intellectual, avoids naturally every such rigid determination as would injure its universal comprehensiveness. Its aim is precisely the opposite to that of the polemist commentators, who found this scripture established as one of the three highest Vedantic authorities and attempted to turn it into a weapon of offense and defense against other schools and systems. A polemist from polemos, Greek, war, so who makes a warring argument. Well, certainly, the fighting between the Advaitins and the Vishishta Advaitins and those who believe that dualism, Dvaita, is the answer to all, have left us a rich legacy through which to wade. The Gita is not a weapon for dialectical warfare. It is a gate opening on the whole world of spiritual truth and experience, and the view it gives us embraces all the provinces of that supreme region. It maps out, but it does not cut up or build walls or hedges to confine our vision. The Gita will say, yes, that is true, and yes, that is true, and yes, that also is true. There have been other syntheses in the long history of Indian thought. We start with the Vedic synthesis of the psychological being of man in his highest flights and widest rangings of divine knowledge, power, joy, life, and glory, with the cosmic existence of the gods, pursued behind the symbols of the material universe into those superior planes, which are hidden from the physical sense and the material mentality. And what is it that links all of this together becomes apparent in the Gita as well, and that is the very sense of sacrifice, the communion of energies, the offering, willing or not, of what we are and do here to that from which we come. And the more we do, the richer we become. Although we don't aim at richness, we delight in the divine. That is all. The crown of this synthesis was in the experience of the Vedic rishis, something divine, transcendent, and blissful, in whose unity the increasing soul of man and the eternal divine fullness of the cosmic Godheads meet perfectly and fulfill themselves. Ah, three in one, transcendent, universal in us, the individual. The Upanishads take up this crowning experience of the earlier seers and make it their starting point for a high and profound synthesis of spiritual knowledge. They draw together into a great harmony all that had been seen and experienced by the inspired and liberated knowers of the eternal throughout a great and fruitful period of spiritual seeking. The Gita starts from this Vedantic synthesis, and upon the basis of its essential ideas, builds another harmony of the three great means and powers, love, knowledge, and works, through which the soul of man can directly approach and cast itself into the eternal. There is yet another, the tantric, which, though less subtle and spiritually profound, is even more bold and forceful than the synthesis of the Gita, for it seizes even upon the obstacles to the spiritual life and compels them to become the means for a richer spiritual conquest, and enables us to embrace the whole of life in our divine scope as the lila of the divine. And in some directions, it is more immediately rich and fruitful, for it brings forward into the foreground, along with divine knowledge, divine works, and an enriched devotion of divine love, the secrets also of the Hatha and Raja yogas, the use of the body and of mental ascesis for the opening up of the divine life on all its planes, to which the Gita gives only a passing and perfunctory attention. What a wonderful sentence. There is a footnote, the tantric. All the Puranic tradition, it must be remembered, draws the richness of its contents from the tantra. The Puranic tradition relevant because so many find the stories in the Bhagavatam, in the Vishnu Purana, etc., etc., speaking of the life of Krishna, to be relevant to what we study and learn here from the Gita. But the Gita is a millennium earlier than the Puranas. And Sri Aurobindo notes that the tantric is less subtle and spiritually profound, but he never had in his lap the writings of Abhinavagupta. Had he been able to see that, it would have been as if looking in a mirror in some respects, because his language in mellifluous Sanskrit is stunningly wonderful. And I commend his reading to you, and also the many texts that informed him, Shiva Sutras, Malini, all those. Lila, of course, means cosmic play. And of course, the tantras have as one of their pursuits the perfection of the physical. And the hatha yoga, the forceful yoga, is meant to enjoin upon the body the rich experiences of the inner being. The raja yoga is not divorced either from the hatha, at least by the time we get to the real definition of what is hatha in the Hatha Pradipika. Swami, who gave that to us, writing it probably, let's say 1,000 years ago, and be generous. He continues the paragraph. Moreover, it grasps at that idea of the divine perfectibility of man, possessed by the Vedic rishis, but thrown into the background by the intermediate ages, which is destined to fill so large a place in any future synthesis of human thought, experience, and aspiration. The idea of the perfectibility of man, of course, was something Sri Aurobindo grew out of in his studies in Cambridge. It was pretty much the end of the age of idealism. The perfectibility of man was a conceit and political philosophy that was very strong in the 19th century. Sri Aurobindo, of course, carries it over, gives it an evolutionary thrust, and brings it into psychological relevance and not merely looking at social change. What does perfect mean, after all, if not to find the core of one's being and know one's soul, and then to transform every layer of life into something that reflects the values of that soul? Sri Aurobindo's integral yoga will be akin to the tantric in significant respects. The tantric is a system that also aims at social transformation, and Sri Aurobindo's yoga is not isolated. It's not an individual's yoga. It is meant to be practiced by the individual within a conscious collectivity. We of the coming day stand at the head of a new age of development, which must lead to such a new and larger synthesis. We are not called upon to be orthodox Vedantins of any of the three schools, or tantrics, or to adhere to one of the theistic religions of the past, or to entrench ourselves within the four corners of the teaching of the Gita. That would be to limit ourselves and to attempt to create our spiritual life out of the being, knowledge, and nature of others, of the men of the past, instead of building it out of our own being and potentialities. We do not belong to the past dawns, but to the noons of the future. A mass of new material is flowing into us. We have not only to assimilate the influences of the great theistic religions of India and of the world, and a recovered sense of the meaning of Buddhism, but to take full account of the potent, though limited, revelations of modern knowledge and seeking. And beyond that, the remote and dateless past, which seemed to be dead, is returning upon us with an effulgence of many luminous secrets long lost to the consciousness of mankind, but now breaking out again from behind the veil. So, a large integral spirit, a spirit that makes diverse elements of truth one, because it arrives at something essential and dynamic, will incorporate these modern limited revelations, which are psychological, which are scientific, which are sociological, and will have a deep and understanding look at the variety of emerging spiritual pursuits, which perhaps began in the 19th century with reawakenings in the Theosophical Society and Anthroposophy, and bringing us into a review of what is essential and an impartable truth in the various schools of Buddhism, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and find that all are friendly to the largest spirit. All this points to a new, a very rich, a very vast synthesis, a fresh and widely embracing harmonization of our gains is both an intellectual and a spiritual necessity of the future. But just as the past syntheses have taken those which preceded them for their starting point, so also must that of the future, to be on firm ground, proceed from what the great bodies of realized spiritual thought and experience in the past have given. Among them, the Gita takes a most important place. So if that is our new base, then we see Sri Aurobindo acting upon his own thesis, because did he not build the integral yoga upon what lay beneath him in the Alipur jail, the very foundation upon which he sat and stood, upon which he danced, was the Bhagavad Gita. Our object, then, in studying the Gita will not be a scholastic or academical scrutiny of its thought, nor to place its philosophy in the history of metaphysical speculation, nor shall we deal with it in the manner of the analytical dialectician. We approach it for help and light, and our aim must be to distinguish its essential and living message, that in it on which humanity has to seize for its perfection and its highest spiritual welfare. Next week, we take up Chapter 2, The Divine Teacher. And if you don't mind, we'll add a little context as we go, week by week. If I don't drive you away, we'll do it together. Look, there's a section in Savitri which will remind us of why this sublime vision afforded to Arjuna in the Gita, not in the 11th, but as he's called to the supreme realization in the 18th chapter, in its closing verses, is akin to what we find towards the close of Savitri, when she, the heroine, the goddess, is lifted up and shown the view from above of what shall be, of what she, her spirit, shall bring to fruition upon the earth. So, I think we'll turn to Book 11, the Book of Everlasting Day. the soul's choice and the supreme consummation. And we'll start at the bottom of 708. When Superman is born as nature's king, his presence shall transfigure matter's world. He shall light up truth's fire in nature's night. He shall lay upon the earth truth's greater law. Man too shall turn towards the spirit's call. Awake to his hidden possibility. Awake to all that slept within his heart, and all that nature meant when earth was formed, and the spirit made this ignorant world his home. He shall aspire to truth and God and bliss. Interpreter of a diviner law, and instrument of a supreme design, the higher kind shall lean to lift up man. Man shall desire to climb to his own heights. The truth above shall wake another truth, even the dumb earth become a sentient force. The spirit's tops and nature's base shall draw near to the secret of their separate truth and know each other as one deity. The spirit shall look out through matter's gaze, and matter shall reveal the spirit's face. Then man and Superman shall be at one, and all the earth become a single life. Even the multitude shall hear the voice and turn to commune with the spirit within and strive to obey the high spiritual law. This earth shall stir with impulses sublime, humanity awake to deepest self, nature the hidden Godhead recognize. Even the many shall some answer make, and bear the splendor of the divine's rush and his impetuous knock at unseen doors. A heavenlier passion shall upheave men's lives, their mind shall share in the ineffable gleam, their heart shall feel the ecstasy and the fire. Earth's bodies shall be conscious of a soul, mortality's bond slaves shall unloose their bonds, mere men into spiritual beings grow, and see awake the dumb divinity. Intuitive beams shall touch the nature's peaks, a revelation stir the nature's depths. The truth shall be the leader of their lives, truth shall dictate their thought and speech and act. They shall feel themselves lifted nearer to the sky, as if a little lower than the gods. For knowledge shall pour down in radiant streams, and even darkened mind quiver with new life, and kindle and burn with the ideal's fire, and turn to escape from mortal ignorance. The frontiers of the ignorance shall recede. More and more souls shall enter into light, minds lit, inspire the occult summoner here, and lives blaze with a sudden inner flame, and hearts grow enamored of divine delight, and human wills tuned to the divine will. These separate selves, the spirit's oneness feel, these senses of heavenly sense grow capable, the flesh and nerves of a strange ethereal joy, and mortal bodies of immortality. A divine force shall flow through tissue and cell and take the charge of breath and speech and act. And all the thoughts shall be a glow of suns and every feeling a celestial thrill. Often the lustrous inner dawn shall come, lighting the chambers of the slumbering mind. A sudden bliss shall run through every limb, and nature with a mightier presence fill. Thus shall the earth open to divinity, and common natures feel the wide uplift, illumine common acts with the spirit's ray, and meet the deity in common things. Nature shall live to manifest secret God. The spirit shall take up the human play, this earthly life, become the life divine. Om Tatastu. Namaste. Jai Ma.